up on the tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
We have a fantastic show in store for you today.
Our guest is Lori Ann Guerrero, and she is sitting with us in the studio right now. Welcome, Lori, to Words on a Wire. And what book are we going to talk about, Tim?
We're going to be talking about her fantastic new book called A Crown for Gomezindo, which is out by Aslan Libre Press in San Antonio. It's a collection of sonnets, right? Heroic Crown of Sonnets.
Heroic Crown of Sonnets.
We'll get into that as well, so we're excited to talk about it.
With illustrations by the fantastic Chicano artist and a friend of Words on a Wire, Maceo Montoya. Beautiful paintings in there.
That's right, yeah.
And, but you know, the one thing I quite frankly did not like about the book was the introduction. It was so pretentious.
Yeah, I know, wasn't it?
I'm kidding. Yeah, the introduction is beautiful, and it's written by our own Tim Hernandez.
Yeah.
I wish you could see this book. It is amazing. The images and the paintings and all that.
It really is. And, you know, just from the sort of early, the new sort of photographs I know that we've seen of the book, you know, it's going to be one of those books that's kind of the artifact that you want to, like, display on your shelf.
Absolutely.
You know, it's really that kind of book, you know.
Absolutely. So it'll be a coffee table book that you actually want to read.
That's it. That's probably the better description for it. It is. And you want to share and show off, you know, to people. It's
and,
that kind of book.
And as I was saying, Maceo Montoya is a friend of Words on a Wire. He's been on the show twice when both his books came out. And, of course, he's the brother of, you know, one of my best friends, Andres Montoya, who you won the first
Lori
you won one of the Andres Montoya prizes
right.
with his first
what
book.
What year was that?
It was 2012.
A Tongue in the Mouth of Dying.
A Tongue in the Mouth of the Dying, yeah.
So it's wonderful how our community just, you know, we're just so close in really crazy ways. And later on, we're going to have Maceo
will call in and join us. That's right. Yeah, he's calling us from California, and we'll talk with him about how the collaboration was and all that. His art was fantastic for this, though.
So let's just dip right into this book immediately. How did this book come about? Why a Crown of Sonnets?
A Crown of Sonnets. Yeah, so for those who don't know, A Crown of Sonnets is a series of 15 sonnets, and the last line of the first poem begins the second, and the last line of the second begins the third, and so on, to form a wreath or a crown. So,
how did you come about that, the heroic Crown of Sonnets?
Well, I read A Wreath for Emmett Till by Marilyn Nelson, which was written for Emmett Till.
Mm-hmm.
I was very intrigued by the honoring of someone in this way. But I also read, or actually heard her perform, or read, Patricia Smith did her Motown Crown.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right.
And
yeah.
That's right. And so, you know, having
that's
these.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And yeah. I loved the, well, I've always had a love-hate relationship with sonnets because of form, inherited form and whatnot, right? And as a Chicana, like, just, bleh. So, I want to make my own form.
Yeah. Andres Montoya and I, and when we were at University of Oregon, used to call it Cracker Craft.
Cracker.
We don't want to do no Cracker Craft.
Well, I never called it that myself, but okay.
Ultimately, we learned that it was a good thing to learn the
craft. Yeah, totally.
And crackers. That's a good thing, too.
So when I read these books and when I heard Patricia Smith read her Crown, I was intrigued. But when my grandfather passed, and this book is written for him, to honor him, when he passed, there was something about the sonnet that I felt, that vessel, that container. He raised me, you know, and I took care of him the last few years of his life. And I felt as if my pieces were sort of drifting away. And there was something about the sonnet that was the one vessel that I could pour myself into.
I love that word vessel, how you're referring to it as a vessel and almost as entombing, you know, his memory and putting him to rest, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, and it was more for me. I mean, I'm a writer, so I was, you know, I always write, and I've always sort of written through these kind of things. But I felt that I couldn't write. Mm-hmm. And it was actually when I was here giving a reading at UTEP in September of 2013, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You were with Dan Vera, who also won a very significant Latino Poetry Prize.
Right. So when my grandfather had just passed in July, and I was here, and there was something about being here in El Paso, on the border, so close to Ciudad Juarez, that I felt there was a sense of homecoming, like this was a place of grief, and I had never lost anybody before. So there was I don't know, like El Paso for me became this place. I started writing the book here on that trip.
I was going to ask you about that, right, that connection.
Yeah.
Because that opens up in your first poem. You actually, you know, you kind of dedicate it to El Paso, Ciudad Juarez, right?
Right. Yeah. And you know, the thing about it was, and I didn't have this realization until I was almost done with The Crown, but I realized, you know, being here, I mean, this sounds horrible, but I was almost jealous of all the women who were gone because they suddenly had my grandfather and I didn't anymore.
Oh, wow, that's beautiful.
Right.
And then came to the realization, or maybe to console myself, that they had him in, and he was where they were not protected in life. They have him now, and for him to protect them in death. And so it was almost like I could only start here, where I could let my grandfather go.
Right,
jeez, that's a beautiful story.
It is, and you know, because as I was writing the foreword for your book, you know, I know we had a couple of conversations and email exchanges. Your grandfather passed in what was it, like June or July of 2013? 2013, so almost 2 years ago now.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of writers will. You know, a lot of us, we write through our grief sometimes. And, you know, we write about loved ones and all of that. But typically, you know, we tend to wait several years before we have – so we can look back on that. But you attempted this, what, like a year after his passing, right?
No, I started immediately.
Oh, wow.
Immediately.
Wow. What was that process like?
Well, I had no intention of it becoming a book or anything. I was just writing because I knew that's what I needed to do to get through, you know, to be able to get out of bed and to function. And I'm actually writing an essay about it right now, about the process of writing this book. But one of the things that I realized was that, you know, I needed – the sonnet became really important to me because it was something about the sonnet that I had to put my emotion aside to use my brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I could use my brain every day and put that emotion aside, then maybe also I could get up and make breakfast for my kids or something,
right,
you know, because those are things that I needed to do and was having a really hard time doing that.
Well, that's really a fantastic narrative testimony of that idea that writing can be therapeutic.
Yeah.
But it's so much more than that. You don't need to know your father. You don't need to know you to get into these poems. The language is lovely and the images are amazing. I remember there was a time when you were working on this because, you know, we're friends. Mostly we communicate through Facebook, like many writers do, that you just needed to come back to El Paso in the middle of writing this and stay in a hotel, for a week and just and just work. And can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, well, because I started The Crown here and I felt like I needed to finish it here. It's a very spiritual place for me and became sacred. And this is where I left him.
And so you had to come back to El Paso, which makes a lot of sense. And tell us about the experience of being in there.
Because
I have an image of it, and it's beautiful.
I actually have pictures.
Talking to the ghosts.
Yeah, totally. I totally was. And actually, by this time, Maceo had sent me images. Like, he was working on, you know, doing the paintings while I was writing. And so I had all 15 images, and I taped them to my wall in the hotel room.
Wow.
And I sat there staring at them in my little table in some little cheap motel room. I lit some candles and I was just very present with the work and with the images. And
That is dedication. You know what it reminds me of? Reminds me of one of those, you know, when you get one of those very obsessed detective movies and they go to the cheap motels and they hang pictures of the dead body parts. Only this is just, you know, you had Maceo Montoya on the wall. Speaking of Maceo Montoya, we should probably let him in on this conversation.
Yeah.
Maceo!
Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Maceo.
Hey,
how's it going?
Happening?
Hi, Maceo.
Hi, Lorianne. Hey, Tim.
Let's talk a little bit about your collaboration with Maceo Montoya, the painter, and also an incredible novelist.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to be here and excited about this conversation.
Oh, it's a beautiful book. We're looking at it right now, these images are amazing. Tell us how the collaboration came about.
I don't really remember how we got started, but I met Maceo in San Francisco, right after my grandfather passed in 2013. And I don't know, I knew I wanted to work with him. there was something that I learned right after my grandfather passed that I felt in communion with people who had lost people. Mm-hmm. And so when I met Maceo, having won the Andrés Montoya Prize, I felt a sense of communion with him, and I knew I wanted to work with him in some way. Maceo, I don't remember exactly how we got started on the conversation of collaboration, but do you remember?
Yeah. I think you were looking at some of my earlier images and mm-hmm. just going, you know, on my website and pulling some images that you felt resonated with the work. And,
right.
And so that's how it started, was can I use, you know, part of this image or a detail from
that's
that image? And I think I sent you some larger JPEGs, and that's really what you were working with. And I think that, you know, you said, is there a mother and child image that you have? And
right. So
I'd go through and look, and some of them, you know, were satisfactory, others weren't, as far as the theme or what you were looking for. And so it wasn't until I actually, you sent me some of the poetry, some of the sonnets, that I started thinking, you know, why draw from earlier work that was about, you know, some other thing, some other emotion,
right.
when there's so much there for me to tap into.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that's when we started the conversation about coming up with new work based on the sonnet.
And, you know, I thought when I first got the invitation to write the foreword for your book, you know, and you told me that the collaboration was with the artist Maceo Montoya, I was really excited because I had just also become aware of his recent publication, A Letter to the Poet from mm-hmm. His Brother, mm-hmm. which does that successfully, right? Fuses the language and the text and the story with his own artwork, which is also elegiac as A Crown for Gomezindo is. So as soon as I realized that that was your idea, it was like, yes, that's a perfect fit. And then, of course, having now seen photographs of the book, now the final product, it looks amazing. And I'm just curious to know how, for you, Maceo, how did that collaborative process work on your end, right? Like, did you get the text and then create images from there, or were there many conversations? How did that work?
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned Letters to the Poet from His Brother, and once that book was released, and, you know, I felt that, in a way, a chapter of my life had ended. And, you know, it kind of encapsulates about 10 years of you know, finding my voice as a writer and an artist, of, you know, dealing with understanding or coming to terms with Andrés's death, and also mm-hmm. my father's legacy as an artist, and so I found myself stuck when it came mm-hmm. to what was going to come next, and I'd go into the studio and I've never had this experience before where I didn't know what to create, or I felt mm-hmm. like whatever I was producing was an imitation of what I had produced before,
mm-hmm.
and It was difficult because I think for me, different from the writing, you know, producing artwork or creating a visual piece was always something very, very emotional that I was able to draw from my gut, and to find that empty was very scary. And
right.
I thought, you know, often that, like, you know, maybe I'm just writing now. Maybe that's what I need to focus mm-hmm. on. And yet I didn't want that to happen. And so, you know, Lorianne, when she presented this idea or this project and sent me the sonnets, in a way it relieved me of having to dig deep and find something within myself.
Right.
And of course that's what I did ultimately, but I was able to tap into Lorianne's grief. I was able to tap into the world that she was creating,
mm-hmm.
and it was easy. It was just, there were so many images,
mm-hmm.
That I was able to draw upon and create from there.
We're talking to Lorianne Guerrero, whose new book of sonnets, A Crown of Sonnets, just came out. It's called A Crown for Gomezindo. And Maceo Montoya, who did the artwork. Maceo, it's interesting to hear that when you read the poems, that it inspired new images for you and that you created them just for this book. You know, which in a way is saying that her poetry inspired you to arrive at an image that maybe you may not have arrived at without the poems. And I'm wondering if that worked the other way around, if when you got his images, maybe it caused you to think about your poems in different ways, and maybe did you ever revise according to one of the images?
That's a good question.
Yeah, you know, sometimes yes. I mean, I couldn't point to exactly. The images were, I mean, it was like he was taking them from my own brain.
Nice.
And there are two in here in which, well, there are many, but there are two in particular that my grandfather's face is.
Oh, that's a lovely image. He's talking about an image of, I suppose it would be you, but let's just say a writer mm-hmm. with a pen. sitting at a desk, and there's a hat on the desk that belonged to your grandfather, and then in the background you could vaguely see the image of the grandfather's face.
Mm. Yeah, that's fantastic.
So when I saw that for the first time, he sent me an email. I was looking at it on my phone. I was making breakfast for my kids, and I just fell to my knees.
Wow.
You know, I was so moved.
Wow.
So yeah, so when I could see, what it did for me was see, I was able to see that he wasn't gone.
Yeah.
When I could see his face like this, you know, despite the fact that I'm writing these poems for him and he's there and he's present in the words, to have that image was necessary for me to finish and to, I suddenly was able to see how important it was.
Mm-hmm. Was this the most difficult book you've ever worked on in your life?
Probably, yes. Yeah, for sure. I mean, because I was grieving, but also, you know, sonnets are hard.
Right, yeah.
A heroic poem of sonnets
is
really hard to do.
Right,
but,
right.
You know, working was, you know, when I lost him, I thought, what would my grandfather do in a situation like this? My grandfather would work. And so that's what I needed to do. I needed to work.
Right, because you mentioned that at one point that, in fact, some of the other interviews that I've heard you do as well, where you talk about how the sonnet is, in your mind, sort of parallel to the kind of work that your grandfather did as a woodworker.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that in terms of the craft and actually having to sort of physically, you know, labor over the sonnets?
Yeah, you know, it was, you know, my grandfather was he was a migrant worker for many years and then became a master carpenter. He had a third grade education. Smartest man I know. He was I grew up watching him create beautiful things, you know, houses, buildings, you know, little things, birdhouses, mm-hmm. everything. And he was amazing.
Right.
And it was him, you know, when I was 16 years old, he's the one who told me I'd gotten accepted to a young writer's workshop at Duke University when I was 16.
Wow.
And so when I was leaving, you know, carpentry, or he didn't understand poetry, but he said,
sure.
And I wrote this, I know because I wrote this down in my journal when he said it, he said, carpentry or poetry, you know, you have to do your best because, and our name will be on it,
right.
You know?
That's great.
And so it was then that I was able to see poetry like carpentry,
wow.
You know? And so it almost gave me permission
right.
to be a poet, even though like he didn't understand it. And to be a writer in my family was not a, you know, okay,
right,
whatever,
right.
Poet. You know what I mean?
Right, get a job.
Yeah, exactly.
We're talking about Gomesindo Martinez Guerrero, who is the subject of Lorianne Guerrero's new book, A Crown for Gomesindo.
Maceo, I'm looking at an image on the 14th sonnet. It's called En las costillas de la página, in the ribs of the page. And it's this image of these figures raising their arms up into the sky. The figures are sort of vague, and it looks almost otherworldly. Can you talk about this image vis-a-vis what's going on at this point in the book?
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's what was so interesting about this process was, you know, feeling free that, you know, whatever image it was that I pulled from the text, that I had that license to just run with it. And that was one of those, I think, where I took a chance. There was like this spirituality, this yearning, this desperation, this element of a lament, a cry, and so I think I just started to work through that on the page as I was, you know, developing the imagery, and I think what was so nice about the collaboration was as Lorianne was working through her poems, and she. In several of them, she ended up editing out the line or the image that I drew upon. But in a way, it's still, like, that was beside the point. Like, what drew me or what I tried to capture represented other aspects of the poem, even though I had narrowed in on just one line.
Right, and so it's the energy that really matters, the spirit, however you want to say it, that goes into it. I know with poets, sometimes a poet will pick up a pen and, you know, write an image or write a first line or even write some sort of sound and get into this zone, and then suddenly they're done and they look at the poem and they're like, wow, did I write that? I had no idea I was going to write that. Does that happen sometimes? Do you follow the rhythm of a brush or the rhythm of a pen as you're drawing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was what was so difficult about being in that place of not knowing, you know, what I was going to create or the reason for what I was creating. And so I think I had to kind of just trust that as I'm moving the brush around or moving the charcoal around on the page, that I could trust that something was going to emerge. And I think that this project definitely helped because, as you mentioned, the energy that captured once I was finished, I had to recognize there's something there. I may not know exactly what it means. I may not know exactly how it relates to you know, the poem or the sonnet overall that Lorianne created, but there's something. There's that emotional core.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think I had to be, you know, kind of learn to be okay with that.
And one of the things that struck me, Maceo, when looking at your work here is how the images, you know, the faces, with the exception of Gomesindo's face, but the other faces, which kind of, you know, are throughout the book, are very, you know, androgynous or ambiguous, at least certainly, right? We can't tell at times if it's a male or female figure, which I really appreciated as I was reading. It allowed me, I think, just to kind of make my own meaning of it. And I'm just wondering, you know, how intentional was that on your part and what was behind that choice?
I think it's a combination of mine and Lorianne's face. So that's what we would look
like.
Oh,
nice. Oh,
I love that.
That is
great. No, that was a joke. Oh,
hey. We all went, oh.
But no, I think that there's something there. And you know, most of my work, both my writing, you know, of course, Letters to the Poet from His Brother, is like obsessed with these male relationships. My father, my brother, I think much of my work, both the writing and the visual work, focuses on how men interpret or understand the world, and for me, there's always this, you know, this place of empathy in regards to my subject matter, and so I think it was very different with Lorianne, is that I had to, in a way, kind of tap into what's it like for a woman to have this intensely close relationship with her grandfather, and how his view of the world has then found its way into her understanding view of the world. And so I think that, you know, that was definitely a challenge as I worked through the paintings. And maybe that's something that, you know, subconsciously that's what emerged.
Well, you know, when we write fiction or when we write poetry, in a sense, even if we're writing from a point of view of an entirely made-up character, we really are writing self. We really are, in a way, writing our own experience, our own psyche, you know, even if it's, you know, exaggerated. And so that fact that when I look at this picture of, like Tim said, androgynous figure at a desk writing with the image of the grandfather in the background, it could very well be you drawing or writing on a desk with an image of Andres in the background.
Wow, that's right.
Yeah.
In other words, both the poetry and the images are just honest. They're honest and they're beautiful. Let me ask one more question, and then we're going to ask Lorianne to read some poetry from this fantastic book. What did you do with the original paintings, and can I have one?
No.
Lorianne has already called dibs.
So. Yeah, I'm sure.
they're still there in a flat file. I think what eventually would be nice is to exhibit them.
Right.
Yeah.
Possibly coordinate that with readings, Lorianne's readings.
Well, good. We look forward to seeing that.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
Lorianne, can you read one of your some excerpts from this book, which is A Crown for Gumesindo?
Sure. What I'm going to do, Daniel, is I'm going to read three short sonnets.
That's
I'm going to read numbers 10, 11, and 12. Stone fruit. Good, I would ask. Good enough, you would say, of the wine we made from plums. Didn't we for years tend the mother tree? Didn't we for years prune, pluck, hold in our hands the purpled bodies bursting that begged, me next, have me? Weren't we so nourished in the nerve? Someone is buying our tree. You are reduced to pit. I put seed in dirt and wait for you to come back to me in a jar by the window. You are not growing. Aren't you a plum? Little red, little kidney, little mouth, singing, calling, I'm here, I'm here. I thought the dirt would give you something to take hold of. I've buried everything I've ever loved. Casketing. I've buried everything I've ever loved in the bone of reason. Now, even in dreams, you are dead. Sometimes I wheel your metal-colored coffin to the grocery store. Once to a papery. Twice to Fiesta Bakery on Pleasanton. You are heavy. Once I was in high school in a play and parked you stage left. Always I shake you. Wake up, damn you. Sometimes the casket is open and I kick you. And when in my small shoes I make contact, your ribs crumble like the bark of an old mesquite. Wake up. Wake up. We can't run the numbers. Argue. Make your mother's bread if you are always going to be dead. Untouchable. If you are always going to be dead, who then will melt away the breasts from my chest? Need more my eyes than the unraveling of my hips. In your house, I was all bedrock and teeth, cutthroat, stopped clock, just as much man as woman or rain. You were blind and I loved you for it. In your house, my shoulders grew to fit the work. Patience blossomed upon my head, a crown. You were my mirror, my name, ready plum of my right hand, my ancient and rivered neck, my compass, my wing, my open gate, my warrior, my sleepless legion, as if I had been born male, my kingdom come, and one day in hot July, my kingdom gone.
We are here talking with Lorianne Guerrero, and she just read from her new book, A Crown for Gomezindo, which is out by Aslan Libre Press, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful.
And Maceo, thank you for joining us. Your book just came out, The Letters to the Poet from His Brother, which has paintings and prose and poetry. And how's that book doing? It's a beautiful book.
It is, yeah.
It's another one of those collectibles that you want on your coffee table.
In fact,
but
what you want to do is you want to go out and get both books and put them on your fireplace mantle right now.
Absolutely.
No, the book is going well, and I'm still reading from it, and I actually have an exhibition in Stockton, and so it's nice whenever I just exhibit my artwork, I'm able to pull from the book as well and read from it.
And I was in Sacramento, I think in November, and we did a reading together at... was it Luna Cafe?
And
you read from that book, and it was really beautiful. Of course, I read the book and blurbed it. It's just a really fantastic honoring your father, who is Malaquias Montoya, certainly one of the most important Chicano painters, artists of our time, and your brother Andres Montoya, who is, with one book, changed Chicano poetry and really American poetry.
Yeah.
Right.
So thank you for joining us, Maceo.
Thank you, Maceo. Thank you, Lorianne.
And check out the book. It is called A Crown for Gomezindo by Lorianne Guerrero with artwork by Maceo Montoya. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
Join us every week for Words on a Wire. And
don't forget, Daniel, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tightrope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy of errors and I'm falling. Like a rubberneck giraffe, you look my past. Well, maybe you're just too blind to see. I'm up in the spotlight. Oh, does it feel right? Well, the altitude seems to get to me. I'm up on a tight wire, flanked by life and the funeral pyre.